Succession number 10657, reel 32.
You were describing the ascent of the hill immediately inland from your beach area.
Yes, I think that, you know, when you get all these obstacles, and these 4 foot high walls were a considerable obstacle, it was very difficult to sort of keep any direction with a couple of platoons up and one back. It all got very raggedy because some people couldn't get over the wall and fell back, so that held up a section while people helped him over and that sort of thing. And it wasn't exactly a textbook climb that we were doing as we went up the hill.
Did you ask the civilians if there were any Germans in the locality?
I think we would have done, but I can't remember doing so, but I'm sure we would have done. If they'd have said, yes, there were, then we might have stopped and completely reorganised everything and gone up in a rather more tidy manner, as it were. I think I mentioned about these two Messerschmitts came over. They'd been strafing the beach, only about 50 feet up as they streaked inland, and the troops were really too exhausted to fire. We could see the pilots. We could have hit them with the Tommy guns, I think. Anyway, the chaps soon pulled themselves together. We found a freshwater well, which wasn't polluted, and this was an absolute boon. And by the middle of the afternoon, both A and B companies were dug in on the high ground, and patrols were probing forward.
What was forward then of your positions on the summit of this hill? Was it open ground?
Well,
up or?
As I remember rightly, it was pretty open actually. And what we were really doing was to sit astride this road that ran towards Pellizzolo Acredi. It certainly wasn't close country of any sort, you know. The other column, which had an objective of getting astride the Pellizzolo Noto Road, Pellizzolo Acredi Noto Road, they had just as tough a climb. And soon after leaving Avola Station, which was almost on the coast, they found dozens of discarded parachutes of all colours, some with supply canisters attached. They were caught in the branches of trees and obviously belonged to American paratroops who had been dropped very wide of the mark. They also found a troop of guns that had been abandoned by the Italians. They'd made no attempt to destroy the guns. There were some wooden huts nearby. The Italians must have cleared out in a panic. The beds were made up for inspection. Their kit bags were still there. So D Company immediately carried out their own inspection and pinched everything they could find in the way of cameras and watches, etc., tins of food and what have you, and moved on again. And meanwhile, down on the beaches, guns, tanks, carriers, and some of the D-Day transport was already ashore. And the carriers came up and joined us. We had all the carriers joining A and B Company in the afternoon.
Presumably they came up on the road.
Yes, 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 they would have come up. Yes, they had to. They couldn't have got up that hillside. They must have come up on some sort of road or track. They arrived in the afternoon. And at 4 o'clock, our three-tonner arrived, the company three-tonner. We'd last seen it 6 weeks ago on its way to an unknown loading destination, which I believe was something like Benghazi, miles and miles away from where we actually embarked. And I think it was very impressive. It improved. It proved the point that if you've got somebody who really does know their planning to the last detail, you can bring everything together at the right time, at the right place. And it was really something. We never thought we'd ever see it again, and there it was. Early in the afternoon, several of our carriers went out beyond A Company along the road towards Pellizzolo Acredi, Pellizzolo Acredi being inland, and they had a short skirmish, brought back two Italian officers and 16 other ranks. Otherwise, it was a peaceful first day on Sicily, and the two colour sergeants of A and B Company went scrounging to see what they could find in the locality. And I went out onto the road, and I was standing there, and a farm cart went by with the family. I think they were possibly making their way back towards the beach area, having evacuated the previous day. And they were all smiles, very friendly indeed, and the small boy sitting in the back was carrying a little Union Jack. I don't know where he'd got it from. And as he went by, he said, "Viva Inglesi." And remembering what the soldier's guide to Sicily had taught us, I said, "Molto grazie. Thank you very much." And off they went, but they were very friendly. And soon after dusk, my colour sergeant Foster, drove in with a little Balila Fiat. And I said to him, where did you get this from? He said, "Well, I found it in a farm." I said, "What about the owner?" He said, "Well, I signed for it." He said, "I gave my name, Kazira Sporting Club, Cairo." And he said, "I gave him a 5-shilling BMA note as a down payment." immediately, Sergeant Major Brannigan, my sergeant major, said, "You better check whether it's taxed and insured. It might get damaged." In fact, it did. It was flattened by a self-propelled gun somewhere on the high ground above Primosole a few days later.
What, one of our self-propelled guns?
One of our self-propelled guns, yeah. A Company got themselves a very smart Lancia Aprilia pillarless saloon, which, of course, was very popular on the odd occasions when we did do wreckers in the next few days. I remember everybody tried to get a lift with Chris Beattie, the A Company commander, in his Aprilia, because if we did get strafed, or we were likely to, the doors just went open and you tumbled out. There was no dividing thing. We didn't have any cycles. Our battalion cycles weren't ashore, so we had a bit of a problem there, because that was about the quickest way of communication, using bicycles, other than wireless, of course. So we had to commandeer some bicycles, and also some carts. Captain Harry Walmsley, the commander of C Company, went one step further and commandeered a horse, which he went riding around on. The Sicilians, in fact, were surprisingly friendly. We were friendly to them. We'd made it quite clear that we weren't going to execute them or anything like that. And they didn't object unduly about the loss of their property. It was rather amusing. Around about 6 o'clock, a little boy came to B Company headquarters, grubby little chap, tear-stained face, and the sergeant major asked him what was the matter. And apparently we'd taken his bicycle earlier in the day, that his mother and father were absolutely furious and had chastised him. Could he please have it back? Well, you couldn't help but feel sorry for him. And we'd by then managed to get quite a few bicycles at B Company HQ, more than we needed. So the sergeant major said to him, "What will you give me if we let you have the bike back?" And so the kid said, 2 bottles of vino. So we swapped the bike for 2 bottles of vino, which he'd left just outside a gate near a field, and he whistled out and came back with the vino. He didn't appear with it when he first came along.
He'd obviously learned bargaining very young.
Very much so, I think, yes. And he rode away, but of course the funny thing was he couldn't reach the pedals with his feet, and it was quite obviously not his bicycle. Never had been. And we reckoned that what he was doing, that he was probably doing exactly the same thing with the other companies, because he gave up trying to ride it eventually, got off and pushed it. And of course the CSM said, "Well, we've been well and truly conned, but we did have a couple of bottles of wine, so it wasn't a bad bargain."
Was it good quality wine?
No, not particularly.
Rough country
very,
stuff?
Very rough stuff, actually. Very rough stuff.
What other sorts of produce did you manage to get from the local civilians in this phase? Did they provide you with cheese or bread?
No,
or
not at this stage, I don't think. No, not at this stage. I don't think they were very much... they weren't very apparent. They were sort of keeping a low profile. But if anybody knocked on the door and said, "Look, we want this or we want that," they gave it quite happily. But I do remember really what I thought was an awful business when we tried to kill a pig. And of course, I mean, a sheep. It was a sheep. And this is not easy unless you are a trained butcher. And I could hear all this going on. And I finally had to put a stop to it. And I said, "For God's sake, you're not doing anything other than making it extremely painful for the animal. And we managed to get from HQ company somewhere, we managed to get a butcher who eventually came along and did it. But the amateurish efforts at killing this sheep on earth again, it was really quite awful. We had to put a stop to it. Anyway, that was more or less the end of the day. We'd got an OP. I forget where the OP was, but it was fairly high. It could have been up a tree or something. But I went up there to have one last look round before turning in. And you could still see the troopers out at sea. It was still quite an impressive sight. And the Spitfires as well were giving cover over the beaches still, and they turned and made off for Malta. And that was the finish of our first day on Sicily. The next day, the Cheshires arrived in the battalion area with them with their vicars, and the battalion anti-tank guns also arrived. C and D companies were relieved during the morning by the 9th Durhams, so C and D actually came into our area, so the whole battalion was together again. They hadn't seen any enemy any more than we had, other than the brush with the carriers. Just after midday, the anti-tank portees and the platoon 1500 weight trucks collected C and D company and brought them back into the battalion area. So we had still got our anti-tank portees and 1500 weights at that stage. During the course of the day, the carrier platoon was out all day. The Germans had been reported in Palazzolo, and in the early afternoon a section of carriers was ambushed by anti-tank guns 3 miles from Palazzolo, and we lost a couple of carriers. On the credit side, the carriers took several prisoners of war during the day, but the loss of the carriers was a serious setback. We could ill afford to lose carriers at that stage.
What were they doing? Just probing forward?
Probing forward towards Palazzolo Acredi. I suppose they'd had a fairly easy run the day before when we'd got the prisoners. And, I mean, like everything else, you don't know there's anything there until it fires at you. You've got to keep going until something does, unless you're going forward by stages and having a look. But I don't think it was that sort of country. They had to keep going with the carriers, and eventually they just got ambushed.
I wanted to ask you about the quality of maps.
Quality of maps. Well, assuming that we had the sort of map we've just been looking at, it was pretty good, actually. I would say that is a very good map for that time, bearing in mind that it was, in fact, I think, produced during the early part of the war. So I think they did a good job on that, actually.
The prisoners that were taken in a little skirmish by the carrier platoon, were they German prisoners? Or
no, I think they were Italians, yes. I think at this time it was, I mean, the Germans were there, but they were busy really at Gila. That's where most of the German forces were, where the Americans were landing. And so we were really still involved at the moment with Italians. And in fact, we had further involvement with them at a later stage, or the brigade did. Shortly before dusk on that, on this Monday, the covering position was handed over to the 1st Gordons of 51 Highland Div. And the 8th Battalion marched, or rather clambered down the hillside. We felt a bit like the grand old Duke of York's 10,000 men. They went up the hill one day and came down the next. It got dark on the way down, and it was really most unpleasant getting over the walls. And there was a great deal of cursing and shouting and what have you. The situation was considerably relieved because the troops were getting a bit bad-tempered about it all, you know, to climb a blooming mountain one day and to come down at the next. Until Walmsley, on his commandeered horse, had his first fall, which led to a great deal of laughter. And I think altogether that he fell off the horse about 4 times, and on each occasion the troops loved it. Of course, Walmsley was absolutely furious. But we ended up in an assembly area just off the coast road, and we turned in for the night.
He wasn't hurt by these tumbles of his horse,
though. Oh, bruised a bit. I think that his ego was hurt more than anything else. We got good news during the night, actually, to the effect that the invasion was okay. The airborne landings, not entirely successful, which, of course, was the understatement of July 1943. The airborne had got the bridge south of Syracuse, which had been one of the most important objectives. Syracuse Port had been captured. And on the left of the 8th Army front, that was in the other corps sector, 30 Corps, very little opposed the assault battalions. And by the afternoon of the first day, the 30 Corps troops had reached the Pacino Peninsula and the airfields, although I don't think they started using the airfields all that quickly. Neither of the British Corps, that's 30, or our Corps, which was 13, had met any Germans. And most of the Italians, particularly the coastal divisions, were mainly concerned with exchanging their uniforms for civilian clothes as quickly as they possibly could, which a hell of a lot of them did, and simply went home. The Americans, as I think everybody knows, hadn't been so fortunate. They'd had very heavy fighting with the Germans around Gila, and the Americans were only able to hold on mainly because the American Navy steamed close in to give very, very close support. And also Patton himself, who went ashore at several of the danger points to personally supervise what was going on. So they had a rough time, but they held on. The sort of general picture now, with the 8th Army on Sicily, Monty's plan was to secure the main road centres and thus restrict enemy movement. And 13 Corps, which was us, we were to advance beyond Syracuse and to take Catania. 30 Corps was to move northwestern inland to the major road centre of Leonforte, west of Catania, and Mount Etna. So, talking about Leonforte, they are well inland and away from us. There would be an airborne attack to speed the advance of our corps on the night of July the 13th, 14th, to capture and hold the Primosoli Bridge. Now, the bridge carries the main road from Syracuse to Catania over the Simeto River. It's about 15 miles south of Catania, and it's vital to get this bridge intact if you're going to move up quickly your armour and your supplies and everything. The job of the airborne was to hold the bridge until 13 Corps arrived.
Because that route runs over the ground that's less rugged and high, doesn't it?
Yes.
If you try to go inland to get round the headwaters of the Simeto, you'd run into mountainous.
Quite a job, which is what happened with 51 Div, I think.
You're much closer to the coast, aren't you?
Yes, definitely.
Coastal plain area.
Yes, yes. I can't remember that there was any really heavy climbing during that march to Primosoli. I mean, I can remember long sweeps of sort of open country and that sort of thing.
So it was undulating rather than...
Yes, I would say. Yes, I think so. Well, now we come on to D3 now, when 50 Div was soon on the move. We left our assembly area at 5 a.m. in the morning. Very little transport had been landed at this time. In fact, some of the transport had been sunk off the beaches. Some of ours had been included in that, I think. But what happened was the battalion was carried by portees of the anti-tank platoon, with the troops hanging on as best they could, and the few platoon and company vehicles that had been landed on D-Day. Here again, I wouldn't have said it was a pretty untidy operation, and if there had been any German air about, we could have been in trouble. But we did 15 miles in the day. We went through Cassibile and then inland to Floridia and Solarino, where we took over from a battalion of the 5th Division. The 8th Battalion wasn't in contact with the enemy, but the 6th Battalion on our left had a scrap with units of the Italian Napoli Division and knocked out several of their armoured vehicles. That night, to our dismay, all the battalion transport was taken away. We had nothing left at all.
Did you know what?
I don't know. We weren't given any reason for it. Obviously, somebody somewhere thought that it could do a more useful job, and that if we had to do anything, we got to do it on our feet, which eventually did happen. But anyway, that was it. It all went, and we didn't have any transport left.
How had the chaps stood up to this 15-mile march?
I'm coming on to that bit next, actually. I think they stood up to it remarkably well. First of all, we did a 10-mile march the previous day, because with no transport, we had to get to a place called Sortino that afternoon. Again, we marched. We arrived late at night, took up defensive positions by moonlight. Now, there was one incident there which, again, was a good morale booster. It was not very far from Sortino, and we heard a lot of machine gun fire from planes above the low cloud. We couldn't actually see what was happening. And then, this all happened very quickly indeed. 6 Stukas literally fell out of the sky, rather like leaves coming off of a tree, in a matter of seconds, really. The Spitz had got the whole lot. They'd been above them, apparently, and had knocked them all out. But apart from this, there was no other enemy air activity. And in fact, German aircraft were a rarity. Those ones we'd seen streaking over us when we got to the covering position. And these Stukas, I don't think we ever saw another enemy aeroplane.
No Italian aircraft?
Yeah. No. So that was, apart from the 10-mile march, an uneventful day. Meanwhile, on the night of July 13, 14, starting about 10 o'clock, the airborne seized Primosole Bridge. I won't go into the confusion there was when some of our troops were actually landed in exactly the same landing zone as some of the German paratroops. But a great deal went on that night, and there was a lot of confusion, a lot of landing in the wrong place and all that sort of business. But they did get the bridge, and they disarmed the demolition charges. Some of them were dropped well away from the target, and it was only a very small force that held back repeated attacks to recapture and blow the bridge, which the Germans were determined to do. By the following morning, the airborne force had been sadly reduced. They still held the bridge, but the vital thing was for 13 Corps infantry to reach the bridge as quickly as possible, and preferably before nightfall. Now, up to this time, the spearhead of 1-5 of the division moving northwards had been 69 Brigade, but now the 3 battalions of the DLI Brigade took over. For this 25-mile march from Sortino to Primosole, 9th Battalion led, the 8th Battalion was next, and then the 6th Battalion. It was hot, it was dusty, the Shermans moving in the column were pushing out diesel fumes, the men were thirsty, weighed down by their equipment, and certainly the officers, the ones who'd been with the battalion quite a while, wondered how they were going to stand up to what would be the longest operational march since France in 1940. On the other hand, the troops knew the plight of the paratroops. They had been told that the paras were holding the bridge until we got there, and that they were having a tough time. And I think we were well over halfway to Primosole when the early evening came on. But then, of course, we'd been at it all day. It was nice and cool then in the early evening, but we'd been in the blazing sun all day. Here again, we had an amusing incident which raised morale. The Shermans were moving amongst the column, and there was a Sherman just in front of my company, and my sergeant major was walking about 10 or 15 yards in front of me. And the tank suddenly stopped, and Sergeant Major Brannigan walked into the back of it, and it knocked his steel helmet down onto the bridge of his nose. And of course there was an absolute torrent of abuse at the tank commander, and it was so violent that the whole of B Company started laughing, the ones who could hear him, and this laughter rippled right the way down B Company and sort of back down the road for almost as far as you could see. And it was those sort of incidents that perked everybody up, you know. After that, it wasn't so bad. Because up to that point, everybody had been walking along with their thumbs inside their webbing, taking the weight of the equipment by leaning forward slightly, and not really seeing where they were going, which was why Brannigan walked into the back of the Sherman. But you got into a sort of zombie state where you walked, and you didn't think about anything. You know, you just walked, and that was it. And it was a peculiar feeling, actually.
On this march, did you do it in the standard way with 10 minutes rest every hour?
Oh, yes. Yes, that's very important. I think there never changes from that. And this was something we could do quite easily. The tank stopped, we stopped, and that was it, you know.
Were you all actually formed up as a company, or was it in platoon columns on the road?
I think you would find that we were using both sides of the road, so you'd have a platoon on one side and a platoon on the other, and then two more with a platoon from another company probably. But the only other way of doing it would have been a single file, and for a whole brigade, a single file stretched out down the road would have been a hell of a lot.
So the platoons were in single file, were they?
But the platoons were in single file on either side of the road, yes. And I would have thought possibly that some... Yes, that would have been about it, I think. I don't think it would have been... It's got to be both sides of the road.
Presumably you weren't marching in step, or...?
No, nothing like that. No, just trudging along, as I say, with our, you know, just in a sort of zombie state. It had, in fact, when it got cooler, we were able to speed up a bit. But it wasn't until dusk that the 9th DLI arrived within a mile of Primasoli Bridge with the armoured brigade, or units, elements of the 4th. I think it was the 4th Light Armoured Brigade. Yes, the 4th Armoured Brigade. When you come to think of it, we had in fact in 2 days done 35 miles of marching, which just wouldn't have been possible if we hadn't have had the training that we had at Suez and Cabrit and that sort of thing. And although somebody somewhere made a ridiculous criticism of the time it took us to get there, they obviously never tried to march with full equipment in the blazing heat of July, otherwise they wouldn't comment.
Did you have anybody who couldn't make it because they had trouble with their feet?
I can't remember, actually. There might have been some, but I think that care of the feet became a major thing when we were planning and training for the invasion, both at Suez and Cabrit. And I think, I say, one of the first things the chaps did when they got ashore was to thoroughly dry their feet after the wet landing on Sicily. So I think foot care had become quite an important part of the training. The paratroops met the 9th Battalion with bad news. They'd held the bridge all day against repeated counterattacks until about 7:30. That was about 2 hours before the 9th Battalion arrived. But the last counterattack, coupled with lack of ammunition, with our paratroops, forced them to withdraw. But still, the bridge couldn't be blown by the Germans because the paras on this side made sure no one came close enough to plant any more charges. So they were pretty close up to the bridge and able to stop the Germans from getting onto it or around it to blow it up. So that was the situation when the 9th Battalion arrived.
So the bridge was in effect a no man's land which both sides could sweep with fire.
Yes, yes, it was. It really was a no man's land almost. Yes, it was, quite right. The enemy were Germans. We knew this. This was known because we got this information from the paratroops. They were not Italians. They, in fact, were the 3rd Parachute Regiment of the 1st German Parachute Division. They'd been in Crete and Russia, and with other units, they'd been flown from the Italian mainland with orders to stem Montgomery's advance northwards. This